This week on Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, we'll be talking to Irish actor and Hollywood leading man Liam Neeson about his new film Taken. Zan Brooks will be joining me in the studio to review some of the week's top releases, including De Niro and Pacino together at last in Righteous Kill, and I've got a huge competition for you. But first, it seems a very modern obsession to list one's top tens or threes or fives, everything from songs to chocolate bars. But for film writer and critic David Thompson, when it came to listing his favourite films, he decided to go for the round, easy figure of 1,000. His new book, Have You Seen?, contains one page for each film, and it's full of wit and insight into the 1,000 films he believes are notable for their qualities, be they good or bad. Now, in front of me, I have a copy of this mighty tome, and I'm very happy to say that I've also got David Thompson in the studio with me to explore its contents. Welcome to Film Weekly, David.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this mighty work.
Thanks.
It is enormous. It's got 1,000 films in it. Yeah. I was expecting it to be 1 to 1,000, but actually it's more than 1,000 pages because of your intro, I presume.
Yes, there's an introduction. And also there's a chronology at the end, so you could look and see how the films fall year by year.
It's very interesting because, I mean, obviously I've grown up with your biographical dictionary of film in its various guises. Which you've kind of gone back and revisited and revised and
more
than people do.
Yeah.
Are there plans to do that with this? Because, I mean, there are films, obviously, that are, you know, will not change, but there are films...
I have already come to the conclusion that there are some films in the book that I would be prepared to sacrifice for some that aren't in the book. So if there's a second edition or whatever, I think there will definitely be some changes in it. But it's not like the Biographical Dictionary, which is a book that involves demands, updating. Mm. So the book is very sincere in one sense, in that there are probably 750 films in this book that I really, truly, deeply love. Mm. And probably always will. That's right.
There's a bit of iconoclasm going on in your reassessments as well.
Sure.
As there always has been. Like West Side Story, I noticed on a flick. Which I think is one of the great musicals. But actually, it's a great stage play. It's a great score.
It was
it's a great dancing. But
much,
the film perhaps is a bit naffy.
The film
though.
Is pretty heavy going, I think. Yes. And also, I think films where the people aren't actually singing are always problematic.
Well, that happened a lot, though, didn't it?
A lot of that, yeah, I'm afraid so. Yeah,
but even in some of the films that you do like, it didn't matter that they were being dubbed.
Well, sometimes it matters, sometimes it doesn't.
Let's look at some of the quirks of the book. I mean, I noticed that, quite interesting, you reviewed two versions of The Killers, the Robert Siodmak film, which recently re-released at Burt Lancaster's debut,
which is a fantastic
film.
Yes.
And then there was a TV version on the very next page, which I've never seen.
Oh, well. You've got a treat. That is it, the TV version, which was filmed by Don Siegel, very, very good director.
He went on to Dirty Harry.
That's right. That is the last film Ronald Reagan made before he gave up that for whatever it was he went on to.
Some form of politics, I believe.
Something like that, yeah. And he plays the villain in the film. He's the king criminal in the film. And, you know, he didn't often do that kind of thing. And it's a fascinating film for that reason. And it's got Angie Dickinson, one of my all-time favorites.
Yes, I noticed that as a guilty
John Cassavetes and Lee Marvin, who plays one of the killers in the title. And, I mean, the Siodmak film, the 1947 film, whatever it was, with Burt Lancaster, is a classic, deserve it so. But you'd be surprised how good the TV version
Absolutely.
Is, too.
Yeah. And then I noticed that you also did two versions of Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yes.
And I wonder why you stopped at two, because, of course, there is a third done by Roger Donaldson, of course.
That's right. I suppose I could have gone to the third. I did the second, because although it's not a great film, it's got so many extraordinary stories about Brando's excessiveness. And that's one of those subjects in film history that I'm endlessly fascinated with. When that guy went off the deep end, he went off like Moby Dick. And
I couldn't quite work out some of the inclusion and some of the exclusion of the British films. I mean, you reassess Great Expectation, David Lean in there.
Yes.
And then Oliver Twist. And in fact, that you sort of say of David Lean that Dickens was an artist, that Lean was an illustrator. You sort of have an admiration for Lean as a British craftsman, but not as a British artist.
Well, I've never been a lover of Lean's later films, the epics. I think they're a bit overblown. Mm. But the more I see of his earlier films, and the Dickens films, which are in this book, but The Passionate Friends, which got reissued
BFI's
recently.
Remasterings.
It's a very, very good film. And I think earlier Lean is the most interesting.
Absolutely, about the Hobson's Choice and This Happy Breed as
and
well.
And Madeline. Have you seen Madeline?
Yes, I have. It's extraordinary.
Remarkable film, yeah. Yeah, no, I think but that was a great period in this country after the war, because you've got Lean, you've got Carol Reed with Odd Man Out, Fallen Idol, Third Man, of course. You've got Powell and Pressburger. You've got Robert Hamer.
Yeah.
You've got a whole host of really remarkable talents.
One of the extraordinary aspects of the book is if you do sort of read it, I suppose it's meant to be read page by page, but dipped into over years.
It's meant to be dipped into.
Yeah,
it's a dipping book. It's a bathroom dipper.
Yes,
if you can conceive of that concept.
Your entry for North by Northwest begins, or thereabouts, says, "The other day I woke up and realised that North by Northwest is better than Vertigo for me as a San Francisco dweller."
Yes.
And you say that I'm at a stage of life where I'd rather have a great screwball comedy than a profound tragedy, i.e. films and your relationship with them change over time.
I think this is one of the most interesting things about studying and watching films, because as you grow older and you know, after you... maybe you've not seen a film for 20 years and you make your acquaintance with it again, you think, oh, my goodness me, it's changed. The film is not the one I saw. Mm. Well, of course, it is exactly the one you saw.
Unless a director's
It's you have changed.
So that is method of watching, the very act of watching changes.
Absolutely. And I think it's a way of measuring what's happened to you in life.
And I always think in a book like this, one travels in sort of hope as well. One should say, well, I'm not going to get to see if my favourite is in there. And then you get to W, which is a long way to go, and you think, oh, my God, I'm going to get there. And then suddenly, having put Room at the Top in there, having put various British comedies in there, would Withnell and I be in there, for example?
And it's not. I know. And that's one of those films that I know I'm going to be challenged for not including, and I plead guilty. However, this is what I would say. For anyone who gets this book and lives with it for a bit, and you've got to live with it for a bit, I would hope that whatever sort of age they were, they might be able to say at the end of it, well, this book directed me to pretty well 100 films I'd never seen, many of which I'd never heard of, and 60 or 70 of them I loved, so I'm grateful.
And that would be the ultimate tribute.
For me, that's the sort of educational thrust here. That's the trying to give people something that will enrich their lives. A lot of people spend a lot of time watching movies.
They do. I know exactly how they feel. I always think another tribute might be with this, David, would be to someone making a modern film noir and have them murder someone with a copy of David Thompson's Have You Seen?
Oh, like the leg of lamb in the Roald Dahl story. Well, it's heavy enough to inflict a mortal blow.
It certainly is. If in your pocket, if not in your neck.
Yes.
David Thompson, thank you for joining us on Film Weekly.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
David Thompson's Have You Seen is published by Allen Lane and is £22 in paperback. That's in money, not weight. For 3 lucky Film Weekly listeners, we've got a copy to give away. Yes, a huge tome to give away. To win, all you've got to do is email me the answer to this question. David and I, in our chat, talked about 3 versions of Mutiny and the Bounty. He expounded on the one with Brando in it, and I upbraided him for leaving one version of the Mutiny and the Bounty films out. Which version of Mutiny and the Bounty did he leave out, and what's the connection in it to this week's Film Weekly show? So, which Mutiny on the Bounty did David Thompson leave out of his book, Have You Seen, and how's it connected to this week's show? Email me at film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Answers on an email only to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. And getting quick, the competition must end next Wednesday, the 1st of October. Joining me now in the film pod is Guardian roving film critic and reporter and writer Zan Brooks. Welcome back, Zan. We haven't seen 1,000 films this week. We'll just content ourselves with 3, I think.
Yeah, 1,000 would kill us in our current sickly state, I believe.
So this week, Zan, we're going to be reviewing Righteous Kill, Red Belt, and A Matter of Life and Death. We range widely over a number of topics here. Let's start with Righteous Kill, because it is the meeting, finally, on film of Robert De Niro and Al Pacino together at last. They did it in Heat for about 4 minutes. They were in The Godfather, of course, together, and they bestrode the 70s as Leviathan's giants of the silver screen. Can they cut it still in the new century in Righteous Kill?
Marcus Smith, a.k.a. Spider. You converted this old abandoned bank at the Club 404 Baum.
Why you call him Spider?
Yeah, he's got lots of arms. Big, big dope deals. Murders, extortion, lots of nice things.
So, three against your five, he's the guy iced those two junkies at Fresh Kills.
Well, the question is if you got the answers. You playing me again, huh, Rooster?
You love it.
Yeah, maybe he sees us, he'll confess.
What, you don't believe in miracles?
When you pick up a check one day, then I'll believe in miracles.
Zan, the heavyweight clash, does it work for you?
It works just in terms of finally we get to see, yeah, these two titans of the American method school kind of together. And it's fascinating to actually see their kind of different acting styles. You sort of imagine that they're pretty much two sides of the same coin, and yet they're kind of different in subtle ways. Like, you know, Pacino has a sort of great flamboyant offense, and De Niro has this sort of coiled, watchful defense. So it is like two heavyweights kind of going at each other. I just wish it was in a better film than this. It's that thing of, you know, you get what you want, and then you think, oh, it's not so great after all.
It's a police procedural, isn't it? It's one of those corrupt cops dramas. There's a serial killer on the loose. Can they find him? Is it a cop? If so, is it a cop that we know? It's one of those films that it says on the poster by the writer of The Inside Man, Russell Gavitz, which is very unusual. Because you've got this, I mean, the big thing about Righteous Kill is, of course, Pacino and De Niro together. And they've managed on the poster to put, but from the writer of The Inside Man. Now, I like The Inside Man. I thought it was a great little Spike Lee movie. He's most famous. But has anyone really seen
it? It's not the unique selling point of this film, surely.
No, but that's what I thought. So I know he's got a very good agent, Russell.
Oh, it's got the writer of Inside Man. It's got these two actors in it as well. Maybe I'll go and see that.
Yeah, absolutely. What it does signal is that perhaps, though, if you like what you did in The Inside Man, which was to whip the carpet away at the last minute, there's a big twist. There is also a twist here.
There's a twist here, but you can kind of see it coming.
You're not supposed to, though, are you?
Well, I'm sure you're not supposed to. You're never supposed to see the twist coming, but if you've seen 1,000 films like David Thompson, you see every twist that's coming. And I actually did see this one too, kind of.
Yeah, so does that ruin it for you, or is it all in the getting there?
It's all in the getting there, but I have to say, it gets there in a very kind of lethargic, waddling fashion. This is a pretty leaden film, really. I mean, if it wasn't for De Niro and Pacino, this would be a bit of a kind of straight-to-video job, I think.
Yeah, this reminded me of those exhibition matches that Bjorn Borg played after he retired.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of prancing around Marbella, maybe playing Rod Laver or some old
Exactly, hit. It is like that. And the thing is, you know, De Niro and Pacino were acted separately in The Godfather 2, you know, one of the great films of the 70s. They are probably the two great iconic American actors of the 70s. If only they'd been put in a film then. That's not to say that they're any less good actors now, but they have a kind of, you know, they need a more rigorous director than John Avner here. They need a sharper script, you know, even though it's by the man who wrote The Inside Man. They just need a better stage to kind of perform
on. This is very sort of pedestrian, it seemed to me. I mean, yes, it's got all that kind of language that police use amongst themselves. There's lots of the gun and the badge, the hammer and the hard hat, that kind of opposition.
The good cop, the bad cop.
Yeah, and they keep referring to Dirty Harry and Starsky and Hutch. It seems to be smarter, but it seems to me it's written by someone who doesn't know cops or the underworld, but he knows cop movies and underworld
Absolutely,
movies.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, but the weird thing is that if De Niro and Pacino wanted to work together, surely there are hundreds of really good, sharp, brilliant directors who would kill to work for them. Why couldn't they have made a movie for, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson or someone like that? Or even if they wanted to go back to sort of past glories, work with Scorsese. But here they're just doing this kind of by numbers police thriller. I mean, maybe the paycheck was very good. I don't know.
I don't think it's huge. It doesn't look like it's a huge
budget. It doesn't look like it's a massive film.
It's also what worried me about this one, Zan, is that there's what they've done is over the years they've kind of cheapened their greatness. I mean, we've seen Robert De Niro analyze this and analyze that, and in the Meet the Fockers, we've seen Pacino hoo-haing and in the Scent of a Woman, etc. Is this a chance you could have rested back and could have reminded everyone?
Yeah, brought back the mantle of greatness on them, and they don't really do it. But of course, the question, though, Jason, that I've got to put to you is, which one is the better? If you're watching this film, which one is...
Because that's the answer, isn't it? Because in those lists of actors, we've been talking about lists in the show already, you know, when Channel 4 did their greatest acts of all time, you know, it was 1 and 2, who's going to win? And Pacino actually won out in the end, which I think people were a bit surprised.
I think they were.
Supposed to be De Niro because he did the boxing, I think. The greater here,
I think was Pacino. Yes, he had a kind of easier
handle. I think so too. And I kind of prefer De Niro in general. But I think Pacino's kind of flamboyance and extrovert nature actually worked with this film. It kind of raised it up a little. It gave it a little bit of life. Whereas De Niro's sort of watchful, seething, pressure cooker presence actually didn't kind of quite serve the material enough.
He's also cheapened by a rather horrid storyline in which he has kind of rough sex with this kind of female cop played by Carla Gugino.
I think De Niro must have put that in himself.
It's really not very nice, is it?
It was kind of weird.
I wouldn't want to be a woman in this film, and I wouldn't want to be a woman watching this film. I thought it was very blokey, very kind of glib, and also kind of nasty as well. So in that sense, I thought, and of course, it's got Curtis Jackson, or as I call him, my mate Fiddy Sen, who was just kind of wasted in all aspects.
Well, he was playing the kind of the identity gangster, you know, presiding over his sleazy club and pushing drugs on kind of, you know, pretty young lawyers.
In a way, I thought this was a bit old-fashioned as well. I mean, perhaps I liked Pacino, because Pacino's always been the better cop, hasn't he? He's been at Serpico, so he always has that with him, whereas De Niro, we're not used to see him as a cop.
I think De Niro's more from the kind of dark side, isn't he?
So I suppose I also thought De Niro looked really old. There were a couple of scenes in it where he reminded me of like those old men that your dad sometimes introduces you to, like your uncle, and he says, go and give him a kiss, and you think, oh, they've got stubble, I don't want to kiss them, ew.
De Niro's actually like 3 years younger than Pacino, but they both are kind of looking their age here. Pacino's got kind of bags under his eyes that you could put kind of luggage in, really. And De Niro's got that kind of stiff, thick-necked quality that comes with old age. But, you know, I guess in that way they're convincing as jaded New York cops, but in a way the jadedness kind of spills over to the film as a whole.
De Niro, and I just also now wears the sort of checked shirts that you used to get from Marks and Spencer that I used to give to my grandfather for his like 85th birthday.
That you tuck into your slacks.
Yeah. It's not cool. It's Righteous Kill, but it ain't cool. Zan, let's move on from Righteous Kill and the pairing of Pacino and De Niro to Red Belt, which sees David Mamet taking to the screen again as writer and director with a fine cast of mainly British people, Chiwetel Ejiofor and Emily Mortimer star. He's a jiu-jitsu instructor in downtown Los Angeles who's down on his uppers after meeting a star played by Tim Allen.
I think it's going to be a great fight. I don't know why everybody's not coming to this fight.
Pay-per-view's pulling back on the promotion. We're not selling tickets.
We have a deal or we don't have a deal.
We need a gimmick. What good's a deal if nobody's making any money?
Tie him up.
Think he has a handicap? No. The other guy has a handicap if he cannot control himself. Breathe. You know the escape. Breathe. There's always an escape.
Your check bounced.
My check?
The martial arts supply. I can't make the rent. You have no cash.
There's one rule. Put the other guy down.
Just calm down. I'm calm, man. I'm calm. You calm down.
Just wanna have a drink.
Why'd you come out alone? You looking for trouble?
What happened?
Bad boy jumped on a movie star.
What about you?
Nobody knows who I am.
Zan, let's do up the jiu-jitsu costume. Let's pair up and spar on the mat. David Mamet, is he a director?
No, he's a better playwright than a director. The weird thing about Mamet, I think, is that he's so steeped in Hollywood lore that it actually makes him kind of stupid. You know, this is trying to be an archetypal film. It's the sort of samurai picture. It's about the soulful loner who takes on a corrupt establishment. You know, but it's kind of rocky with pretensions, I think. And Chiwetel Ejiofor is fantastic in it, but the film itself is kind of hogwash.
Yeah, it's Mamet scripts, I think, must be great when you get one on the table as an actor and it comes and you get to do that kind of firing dialogue and get to say, give me some velocity, give me some variety. And you think, great. And it's all about the con and the trick and the language of the sort of underworld that it goes into, be it card sharps, be it con men, be it here are boxing promoters or fight promoters. But then when it comes onto the screen, it comes across very stilted. There's a sort of a manner in which you have to do Mamet.
Yeah, it's a sort of theatre workshop. And, you know, it goes on and on, this. And, you know, the thing about Mamet is this is a film along very kind of established Mametian lines. It's a film about honour and dishonour and corruption and nobility and heroism and what maketh a man. And yet the really good Mamet scripts, I think, kind of explore those codes of masculinity, where this is almost kind of getting off on it. It's verging on masturbation here, I think. He obviously, you know, he's been studying apparently martial arts for 5 years. And this is obviously his big thing at the moment.
Well, maybe we should be careful what we say about
him. Well, exactly. He'll storm in here and have you in a half Nelson in no time at all. And he's obviously kind of identifying perhaps with the Chiwetel Ejiofor character as the sort of the pure warrior in an impure world. But it's all a little bit tiresome, I think.
I thought that normally Mamet has a lot of interplay between the sexes, whether it's Oleana or even if it's Glengarry Glen Ross, it's all about the men and there are no females around. Here there were quite a few female characters, and again, I didn't think he really knew what to do with them.
No, they're kind of real stock female characters, like the hero's wife is this sort of greedy Brazilian designer who wants more money and is prepared to sell him out.
The lovely Alice Braga,
who's absolutely beautiful, but a mean beauty, an untrustworthy beauty. And the Emily Mortimer character is this sort of jittery, victimised lawyer who the Chiwetel Ejiofor character kind of saves and raises up.
She can tuck away Jack Daniels, though, I noticed.
Well, this is a Mamet film. You know, that's in the contract.
There is a lot of jiu-jitsu in it, which sounds a very strange martial art to have picked because it's kind of a new martial art and it's all about the kind of the corruption. And so, of course, Ricky Jay, a Mamet regular, appears as a boxing promoter. And we've got other sort of Mamet regulars, Joe Mantegna as a kind of Hollywood fixer. So those Mamet obsessions with Hollywood and its kind of underbelly and its kind of the falsity of movies, which I think he examined probably better in State and Main, rears their heads again here, only to get into an arm lock.
Yeah, but it kind of, all of this builds to a really kind of ridiculous climax where the hero who has never fought competitively because he's so pure is finally forced to fight competitively. And so, you know, you have this kind of Rocky-esque finale without, you know, giving too much away. It all ends wonderfully and, you know, victory comes from a sort of a slightly left-field way, but it's all within the Mamet world of honour and nobility. Yeah, again, what maketh a man?
That said, and I enjoyed it. I kind of was there with the tension, and there are things about Mamet, you know, nevertheless, it may be Mamet, but it is Mamet. There is at least a stylist at work here. There is
he's
something.
A serious filmmaker. I mean, you know, he knows what he's doing, but this film just didn't have any kind of nuance or depth. It was an arrangement of these archetypal mythic elements, and yet surely you have to kind of play with those. You have to kind of muddy them a little bit, mix them up. This was a kind of thesis in search of a drama to kind of wrap around.
I get that with some of the good film writers. With Woody Allen's kind of recent work, you sense there's a really good script there, but that actually they don't really care about the process of making the film. They get the actors to work it through. It's almost like being present at a read-through, the first read-through of the script. You think, oh, this could be really good if they gave it a bit more money and a bit more work.
Yeah, but it's Mamet, so you know, his word is law and it's the Bible and he has something to say and God damn it, you're going to come in there and say it. And that's it. The film is kind of almost made before the cameras roll, which removes that element of surprise and chaos and interest, I think.
That's Red Belt, starring Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I think is very good, and written and directed by David Mamet. Let's move on to a couple of very fine filmmakers, indeed, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, whose A Matter of Life and Death is re-released at the BFI as they celebrate their 75th birthday. It's David Niven, it's an airman foreseeing his death, if only heaven had not made a glaring administrative error.
I've fallen in love because of your mistake. I'm in an entirely different position from what I was in last night. Then I expected to die, I was ready to die, and it wasn't my fault that I didn't, it was yours. What kind of government do you represent?
I do not represent any government.
Well, what laws govern the place you come from?
I am not permitted to express any political views.
Well, if it's a respectable place, there must be a law of appeal.
But my friend, be reasonable. Appeal to whom?
That's for you to find out.
But this has never been done.
Is that any reason why it can't be done now?
You are determined to get me into the salad.
And what about the salad you got me into?
Now, look here. You don't want me to use force, do you?
Well, you can always try.
I think I'll leave you for a little.
That's the form.
I shall report for instructions.
Now you're talking.
And do not fall any deeper in love now. You have been warned.
Zan, this is re-release. Why have you picked this one to talk about?
Why have I picked this one to talk about? I love this one. I love Powell and Pressburger. I think that they're kind of unique in British cinema. A Matter of Life and Death was apparently Michael Powell's personal favourite of all of his films. And it's probably his most complete and assured. And having said it's complete and assured, it's also very weird.
Yeah.
It's kind of got so many kind of odd little pockets and strangeness. There's a sort of the naked boy Piper on the beach when David Niven crash lands. There's the weird thing of heaven being shot in this kind of gleaming monochrome and Earth being basically this kind of exotic, abundant kind of technicolor paradise. It's a beautifully composed film and it's a kind of weirdly moving film as well.
Camera work by Jack Cardiff, of course, and that sort of as the angel says when he comes down, everyone is starred for Technicolor up there. Technicolor is the color of the world, but it is an otherworldly color, nevertheless. And I think they always played with that panel press program in Black Narcissus.
Yeah.
Color is something you
and
can
the red
achieve,
shoes
and the red
as well.
Shoes. Color is something to be earned.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it kind of wallows in it. They're the most kind of exotic and kind of wanton filmmakers. And everybody says, oh, British cinema is a little bit kind of stiff and formal and things like that. And they just weren't at all. There's a real strange kind of Celtic, exotic quality to their films.
I suppose that the readings of films like this change with every generation. And it's interesting that you and I both love the film. But presumably when it was made, it was received very differently because it was just after the war and it was done as
a propaganda piece, really. Yeah. I mean, and also it was it was a celebration of the relationship between a British airman and an American servicewoman. But basically, it's a celebration of the special relationship between Britain and America. And there's a lot of kind of humour to be had in this sort of celestial tribunal that they have.
And all the Yank airmen coming into heaven with their cigarettes and their
and they play a snatch of radio commentary on a cricket match, which is very kind of like learned British tones, and then cut that to American big band playing. And so there's kind of a lot of humour to be had in these sort of cultural differences, but it's beautiful and it's still kind of weirdly pertinent now, I think.
I think it kept getting remade. Of course, Heaven Can Wait was one of them. And the idea that an angel comes down and kind of looks over us, is that still I found that still kind of comforting in a way. I know it's kind of hooey and nonsense and perhaps like I should have put that behind me, but there's something rather lovely in the thought that there is a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will.
Absolutely. And the great thing about this is that it basically posits a benign universe where, of course, they screw up, but they're trying to put things right and you've got a fighting chance to order your case and things like that. But this isn't a kind of religious film in that the whole thing could actually be, you know, the nightmare of a damaged brain. That there's a, you know, the suggestion that all David Niven is suffering from is a brain tumour and that needs to be operated on. And that's never completely kind of pushed under the carpet and cleared away. So you can read this in a sort of variety of ways. It's possibly a profane film in a way, that it's basically saying there's no heaven on earth. You know, there's nothing like that. But it's beautiful. It's beautifully done.
No matter how hurt he is, how dead he may be, that moustache remains beautifully chiselled and perfect, does it not?
I love David Niven. I think he's great. And this is sort of one of his great roles. But also we should mention Roger Livesey as the defence counsel who pleads for him. And, you know, this June Allison is the romantic interest, but really the real interesting relationship is between Niven's airman and Roger Livesey as the sort of straight arrow doctor.
And there's a little performance from Richard Attenborough, and I think it was his third film as one of the sort of angels, his little moony face hanging out. And there's an interesting bit of casting that Kathleen Myron plays an angel here, and she pops up in Saving Private Ryan. I think she's
Ryan's
mum. And Spielberg, I think it was my colleague at The Observer, Philip French, who wrote that. Of course, Spielberg must have cast her because she's got that angel quality still from Matter of Life and Death. And Spielberg actually wrote back to him, little anecdote here, and said, actually, I never thought of that at all.
Really?
But thank you for pointing it out. I never even remembered that she was even in The Matter of Life and Death.
I think Spielberg should take more advice from Philip French.
Zan, thanks a lot for joining us again on Film Weekly.
Thank you.
Zan will be back next week, but if you want to keep up with Zan Brooks's reviews and all the other interviews and news from him, go to guardian.co.uk/film. The actor Liam Neeson has always had a rare talent to portray both physical and cerebral characters. His boyhood passion for boxing provided Liam with his distinct physical poise and perhaps the most sought-after broken schnoz in Hollywood. He's best known for his role, of course, as Oscar Schindler in Spielberg's haunting Holocaust film Schindler's List. But his versatility has seen him play characters as varied as Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn, the Irish rebel Michael Collins, and, of course, scientist Alfred Kinsey. His latest film sees him once again play the thinking man forced to take action. Taken is directed by Pierre Morel and written and produced by Frenchman Luc Besson. Neeson plays Brian, an ex-CIA agent, faced with the task of rescuing his daughter, who's been captured by evil sex traffickers in Paris. I met up with Liam to find out why he's taken this new action role. But first, let's get a taste of Liam in Taken.
Because you do business overseas through multiple shell corporations. Because you were involved in an oil deal with a bunch of Russians that went south 5 years ago.
Well, how the hell do you know about that?
Because I was not going to let my daughter live with someone without knowing everything about them.
Yeah, well, I have a few resources of my own.
Now's not the time for dick measuring, Stuart. I'm going to ask you again. Do you have anyone who's looking to hurt you?
Not that I know of.
Which room's Kim's?
I want to know what happened.
I got a call from her. There were people in the apartment, then she was taken.
Oh, God.
Which one?
That one.
Is there something I should be doing?
You have a lease agreement with NetJet through your umbrella company in the Bahamas.
I do.
Get me a plane to Paris.
Okay, for when?
An hour ago.
Lee, congratulations on your new film, Taken, of course, which it seems to me that your career has taken a new turn in this one, because now you're kind of the avenging action hero, which is a sort of a new role for you, even though I've seen you be active before, but this is action. This is close-up, nose-breaking, neck-breaking stuff.
It is. It's pretty ruthless and relentless too, you know. Take no prisoners type action, yeah. You know. So, it's a genre I've always been interested in, loved as a kid. And Luc Besson sent me this script about 3 years ago, and I thought, gosh, I'd love to do that. I mean, it was a real page-turner, I thought. And was very kinetic and dynamic, and I thought, and I loved the whole physicality of it, and I keep pretty fit in real life, so I thought, yeah, I'd really like to do this, on condition that I can do all the fights, which I did, I'm very proud to say.
Right. Cause, I mean, because you were a fighter, of course. You grew up as a fighter.
I was a boxer.
Right.
Big difference.
A pugilist.
I was an amateur pugilist in Ireland, yeah.
So there's a big difference in this. What you're saying, this is because this has no rules, this has no... you're not a gentleman fighter in this.
Not really, no, no. And even though we actually incorporated two or three different martial art forms in the fighting that we use in the picture. But it's still down and dirty and mean and hard.
So did you learn some new martial arts for this? You learned all the moves? Because it really is close-up stuff.
It is, and very, very fast too. I mean, the speed you saw it happening is the speed we executed it at, you know.
So you can do all that?
When the camera was turning, I was able to. But we had lots of... rehearsal time,
right.
and intense rehearsals too, and obviously they had all the fights had to be choreographed. So it's kind of like learning a dance, and you have to, with your stunt partner, you have to get very, very easy with it, you know, and very relaxed, of course, you know.
It seemed to me that it was also a new role, almost politically, for you as well, because it's not on the outside a political movie, but if you look at it a little bit closer, the kind of parable level, the allegory level of it, it is quite political. You seem to sort of be a kind of an American out there for revenge in nasty old Europe, which is full of kind of Albanians and fat sheikhs.
I know, it's very politically incorrect, isn't it?
Yeah,
actually,
it is, if you don't mind me saying, Liam.
It totally is. I absolutely agree.
Is that something you thought? I mean, I say this, and I mean, I know that you're a great gentleman and wouldn't mind me sort of bringing up the non-PC aspect of it, but it's only because you've done so many fantastic hero roles that are so political and morally upright. I'm thinking of Schindler, I'm thinking of Michael Collins, I'm thinking even the voice of Aslan. My God, you can't get more moral than that.
I guess that's true, isn't it? It's good to shake things up a bit, you know. And yes, I know you could attack the film, say, well, you know, this takes a very perhaps racist stance against certain stereotypes and stuff, but there's something, and I've found it with this film, sitting with an audience watching, that they connect with in some way, that redeems something, I think, they may be feeling about society, about how they've been treated in society, that's taps into the incredible power of cinema, that you go into a darkened room and you connect yourself consciously with a hero or a villain, and they kind of expunge the feelings you're having, and you leave the theatre hopefully feeling a little bit cleansed in some way, you know?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's a father's search for his daughter, which it could be John Ford we're dealing with here. And I know you recently did a Western in Seraphim Falls, of course, although you were a nasty piece of work in that as well, actually.
Well... You know, vengeance is vengeance. Yeah. You know?
I mean, you mentioned the childhood hero. Who did you grow up watching in terms of those monumental screen heroes?
I did absolutely love Westerns, that's for sure. And he was, strangely enough, the most decorated war hero of the Second World War, Audie Murphy. Or Cinema and Ballymena seemed to get Audie Murphy westerns every other weekend. Yeah. And I absolutely idolized Audie Murphy. And I remember once reading, someone gave me a film annual, and Audie Murphy's bibliography was in the back of this. And Audie Murphy, and I was reading about him, where he was born and stuff. And at the end of this, it said something like, he single-handedly killed 247 Germans. Something like that. And it was such a shock to me that the love affair kind of ended in a way, you know?
You have, now I think of it, especially with this new role as Brian, you kind of muddy the waters of what hero is, and I suppose that's probably what the world's doing at the moment. You know, you've been a different type of hero, and even Oskar Schindler was a conflicted hero as well.
Yes, he was. He most certainly was. Nothing's ever black and white anymore, really, is it? Not you know, there's all shades of grey there.
Huge thanks to big Liam Neeson there. And Taken is released nationwide on Friday from the 26th of September. Thanks also to my other guests this week, to David Thompson and, of course, to Zan Brooks. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my newly married producer, Jason Phipps, it's congratulations and goodbye.